The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Alok Jha. You're listening to Science Weekly. In this week's show, we're going to spend the entire programme looking at the relationship between science and government policy. Why is the science and policy relationship often so difficult and sometimes downright dysfunctional? What can we do to improve it? How does the design of a scientific advisory system actually affect policy outcomes? And really, what weight do scientific advisors have with ministers? This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. In the studio today, we have Chris Tyler and Rob Doubleday from the University of Cambridge Centre for Science and Policy. They've spent the past few months questioning science policy experts to try and come up with a series of lessons and challenges on how to improve the way science is used to inform public policy. Also here is Mark Henderson, a journalist and author of the forthcoming book, The Geek Manifesto, in which he explains how we can entrench scientific thinking more deeply into public life. We'll also hear from the UK's Minister of Universities and Science, David Willetts, and from Imran Khan, the Director of the Campaign for Science and Engineering. Welcome to the programme, everyone. Chris, can we start with you? Can you explain how the government hears scientific advice at the moment and what it uses it for?
Yeah, the government in the UK has a really quite outstanding set of scientific advisory mechanisms. There's science advice coming from outside, and there's also science advice coming from within the system. So we have, for example, a chief scientific advisor who works directly to the Prime Minister. Each government department has a chief scientific advisor, and that advice filters down through a system of expert disciplines, including statistics and economics and science and engineering and social research and so on. And that fits in with a process where we've got advice coming from outside through science advisory committees and councils. Also, the universities, professional learner societies are also very active in making sure that there's a voice of science.
So it sounds like a lot of people are involved. There's lots of advice flying around. I mean, how has it evolved in the past decade or so?
It has evolved a lot over the last decade. And a lot of the changes that have happened really came about as a result of the BSE crisis. The science advisory system in response to that crisis didn't work terribly well. There are a number of flaws.
Just to remind everyone, this is late 80s, early 90s, the idea that BSE was being spread around in cattle, could it spread to humans? The government was very clear in the late 80s that that wasn't going to happen. Take us forward from there.
There were mixed messages coming out of the process. There were things that scientists knew and things that they didn't know, but there was a lack of clarity in respect to the advice going into government and then, of course, out to the public on both of those points. But, of course, that old saying, never waste a good crisis, and to be fair, the science community didn't. As a result of that, there's been an enormous change in the way that science advice is handled by government, and that has gradually got better and better. The foot and mouth crisis was another opportunity to show what had changed and how to improve again. But then we've had bird flu, and over the last 3 years, we've had the annual Easter crisis, swine flu, the Iceland volcano going up, and Fukushima, of course. And I think it's fair to say that step by step, that science advisory system has got better and better, at communicating within the government processes the scientific issues at hand, but also, of course, communicating out to the public.
Rob, why do governments actually need to hear scientific advice at all? I mean, they're elected politicians. They can get evidence as and when it befits their policies. Why do they need scientists, independent scientists specifically, to work with them?
Well, the challenges facing governments, you know, are very immense, and science is just one of the kinds of inputs that governments listen to try and get a better understanding of what the policy challenges are they're facing and what kind of options governments have to deal with them. I think the important thing is to think about scientific advice in the context of all the other kinds of advice that governments get. I would think it would be wrong to think of it as something completely different and completely special, but it is a critical part of the way that governments can characterise the kinds of problems that they deal with and the kinds of ways they can address them.
Mark, is scientific advice, I mean, there is a tendency to think that scientific advice is just about science policy. It's about deciding where to put your £1 billion for nanotechnology or something. What's the bigger picture here that, that people sometimes miss?
Well, of course, science is really central to a surprising number of policy questions. To give a really good example of this, David King, who was the government chief scientist for a long time, told me a story recently about how he was meeting with various civil service mandarins from, I think, every department was present. And he challenged them and said to them, well, can you name me an area in which science is not relevant? And believe it or not, the mandarin from the Department of Social Security stood up and said, well, my entire department. Now, that I found to be absolutely incredible, in that if you think of actually what are the issues for Social Security, what's actually going to shape that over the coming years, well, the biggest one by far is the ageing population. And yet there was a mandarin thinking that actually science was not relevant, I suppose, because he was thinking of science as a body of knowledge about maybe photosynthesis or radiation or that kind of thing, rather than as an approach to problem solving and actually as an area where there are actually quite a lot of inputs that could have had a very direct relevance for his department.
Well, let's hear from Imran Khan of the Campaign for Science and Engineering. I asked him what an ideal system of scientific advice for government would look like.
For me, the biggest two things when you're looking at how to make sure good government is supported by good evidence are transparency and also independence. And that means independence of the people who are doing the advising from government. And together what that allows is if you've got people who aren't worried about their jobs and feel like they can communicate what they're saying to the public and to politicians, that gives them a challenge function. So it means that if a government comes out and says, we think, you know, killing badgers, for instance, is a good way to reduce the incidence of bovine TB, then scientists who advise government and who disagree with that policy can then come out and say so. But if you don't have transparency, you don't have independence, you don't get that challenge function. So I think those three things combined, transparency, independence, and being able to challenge policies, are what makes a really good system.
So this is the case where you have as good an evidence base as possible, then it's up to politicians to do with that as they will, but all in public.
Well, exactly. You know, you can have a fantastic evidence base, tell politicians exactly what the scientific research says, and yet if the politicians are just able to completely ignore it and go off on their own steam, then what's the value of that research base? There has to be some way of making sure that politicians are accountable. And that's not saying that they have to follow the what scientists say to the letter, because ultimately they're elected and the scientists aren't. But they've got to be able to defend what they're doing. And that's got to be off the back of scientists and other researchers being able to say, here's what the evidence base says. So we are held up worldwide and particularly within the EU as a paragon of how to do this. Having said that, we all know instances where it's gone wrong. We still have departments that don't have chief scientific advisors. We still have instances where the government brings out policies that aren't well supported by research, even where they could have been. So I'd say on balance, they probably get a 6 or 7 out of 10.
What are those departments that don't have the scientific advisor? And specifically, what would they benefit from if they had a scientific advisor?
Well, for instance, one of the long-running ones was HM Treasury, and it's a slightly bad example because they've only just got around to employing their first ever one. But for a very long time, years and years, the Treasury was the only department not to have a chief scientific advisor. And on first sight, you might say, well, why does the Treasury need a scientific advisor? You know, it's not like they're dealing with disease or, you know, high energy physics or anything like that. And of course, we're not saying that you should get some kind of, you know, molecular biologist to come in and be the chief scientist at HM Treasury. But what it does is gives you someone, ideally, who's in that department with the challenge function to say, well, if we're rolling out this new intervention, say, you know, let's say something relevant to science, like the research and development tax credit, that's there to give UK-based companies incentive to do more research. And you can frame it in different ways that, you know, incentivize different things. What would be fantastic is to make sure that there's someone there who's saying, well, is this intervention designed in the best way? How can we go and test this to make sure that the UK benefits the most from these policies?
And the Department for Culture, Media and Sport, the department responsible for delivering the Olympics this year, that doesn't have a chief scientific advisor as well. Again, is that an urgent thing? Is that something on your radar?
Well, that's the thing. You know, these things are never urgent until something urgent happens. You know, the classic case is when we had the ash cloud, you know, a couple of years back. Before that happened, no one knew that was on the horizon. But by making sure you've got a really well-developed scientific advisory network, you're well-placed to cope with that as and when it happens. Similarly with DCMS, you know, who knows the next time, say, there's a crisis that hits the mobile phone networks, which, you know, falls into DCMS's purview. That could have major implications for communication across the UK.
Imran Khan there. I also spoke to David Willetts, the UK's Minister for Universities and Science. I asked him about the differing prominence of scientific advisers in different departments and whether these scientists should be challenging ministers or just providing scientific support.
Individual departments have their own ways of working. I don't believe in complete uniformity, but I think there is a growing camaraderie and collegiate spirit amongst the government's departmental science advisors, and indeed that's partly embodied in a weekly breakfast meeting that John Beddington chairs, which I sometimes go along to myself. So they can pool intelligence about what's going on, people can try out problems on each other, and so I think the overall, the sense of it as a professional cadre of scientists, so nobody in one department should feel in any way isolated. I think that's growing, and it's great to see scientists and the scientific discipline within government self-confident, which I think they are.
Would you like to see more scientists getting involved with policy and politics? At the moment, a few people do, of course, and you have the advisers, but more generally in Parliament or in consultations or in select committees, would it be valuable if more people of scientific mindsets were involved?
Yeah, I mean, of course, well, it has to be careful. I'm very aware. For example, I don't claim to be a technical scientist. I hope that I'm an empiricist. I think the real challenge is creating a culture that supports evidence-based policy. And I think there we're making great progress. And indeed, I would say the coalition is good for evidence-based policy, because every ministerial meeting I go to, you know, there are people from two different political parties present. And so there's always, you can't simply appeal to kind of tribal loyalties to get things through. So that's what really matters. But there are, in biz, we have large numbers of people with a scientific background who are working in the day-to-day policy divisions, as well as having their own distinctive network of scientists working for John Beddington and our science advisor.
The other big difference, I suppose, between politicians and politics and the way that scientists work is that scientists are very comfortable with uncertainty and changing their minds a lot. Politicians famously don't like changing their minds, in public at least. Is that a divide that can ever be bridged, or do you think that it's something that's necessary just to keep that tension up?
Well, when you say politicians don't like changing their minds, remember that's partly because the way we serve the electorate is by a degree of predictability. When people vote for a political party, they're also voting for a kind of view of the world, and they don't know exactly. Nobody can show exactly what the problems are going to arise in, like, in a five-year life of a parliament. But they are voting for a kind of approach to deal with these problems. They rarely just say, I'm voting for someone to look at the evidence case by case and decide what to do. And so this is not just some kind of defect in politicians. This is how the democratic process and accountability works. But the way I would bridge that gap is I would say we politicians work within what in the philosophy of science would be called a research program or a paradigm. And we do tend to work within that. And the big crisis in political parties is when a kind of paradigm, a view of the world has ceased to be fully effective. It has to be shifted. But just as there are scientists who work within a research agenda, I think we politicians do the same. I think there's another difference, which is perhaps even more important. And that is, if you can use a medical analogy, politicians are GPs, not hospital consultants. You're often taking decisions with limited amounts of time, with a limited amount of information. You can't always say, well, let's wait a month and get some new biopsies done and get some extra x-rays and then come back. Sometimes you can, but not always. And again, I think there's growing mutual understanding, and scientists understand that politicians are taking decisions under those type of constraints.
That was David Willetts, the UK's Minister for Universities and Science. Rob, Chris earlier said that the UK has an exemplary system of scientific advice. Is there a way that we can get better, though? I mean, tell us about the exercise you've been doing at the Centre for Science and Policy.
The Centre for Science and Policy, which is at the University of Cambridge, exists to try and promote the use of scientific evidence in policy. And so for us, it was just a short step to go from that to thinking about, well, what is the state of the evidence about the science policy process, the scientific advisory process? So we have started this January to set up a full-time research program to try and address those kinds of questions. And that in part means carrying out research to try and understand how science advice works in practice. So one of the things we're doing, for example, is carrying out interviews systematically with all chief scientific advisors who are still alive in the UK to try and get a better sense of how that role has evolved over the last few decades. Another thing that we've done recently is to convene a group of people that, so this is academics, scientists who are involved in scientific advice, policymakers, practitioners, to come together and through a kind of deliberative process, work out what are the key questions that, if answered, would help us get a better understanding of how science advice works in the UK, but also internationally. And that's really the first time that's happened to try and build up a collaborative research agenda to try and take forward this set of questions.
So what kinds of questions did you come up with? There are the obvious ones, I mean, how can science be used better in government? But I'm assuming that this august group must have come up with something a bit more challenging than that.
Yeah, I think there's sort of three groups of questions. One was that set of conceptual questions. How do we understand science and government? You know, how do we understand these categories? How do these things work together? There were a second group of questions around the process. How does it work that particular policy questions get identified as ones that really require scientific input? How does that scientific input happen? According to what kind of channels does knowledge flow? So kind of looking at the process. Then there was a third set of questions that was really around if we take the kind of the state of the art knowledge about science, what is scientific knowledge? How does it work? What are its limits? And then we think about, with that kind of knowledge about science, how do we then understand the proper role of science in government? So, for example, we know that uncertainty is always part of science. We know that there is never a complete consensus around science. Part of the purpose and the way that science functions is very good at throwing up differing views about what the matter is. And so how do we think then about scientific knowledge, how it works, the endemic uncertainties, the inevitable difference of views? How does that then work in the context of policymaking, which is always about coming up with a set of decisions that do have some kind of political legitimacy?
Science is meant to be a dispassionate affair. You go where the data takes you, and in a sense, the interpretations come afterwards and they can be changed. But with scientific advice, things can get regularly quite controversial. Let's take climate change as an example of that. There's lots of discussion, as we all know, around the particular levels of effects of various things around the world in terms of temperature and future, and the models are just that, models. But the consensus is climate change is happening, it's anthropogenic, it seems a shut case as far as if you're scientific is concerned. Why is this such a hot political potato?
I think it's a great illustration of what I was saying earlier, that this is a hugely important public policy question that has very major scientific dimension. But what we do about climate change has the most dramatic consequences for how we order our societies, what kind of choices we make about how we live. Science is part of it, but only part of it. The kind of controversies we see are really about these big political questions, how we want to live in the world. Science is not going to resolve those.
But, but science gets dragged into all of this, and it's sometimes people misuse it as a way. It's almost like there's a splashback effect.
Yeah. But that's inevitable. You know, that's what we're just going to have to understand and live with. Science plays a part. It will never provide the solution. You know, more and more sophisticated models, more and more accurate predictions are not suddenly going to drive political consensus. They just get caught up in it.
Mark?
No, I agree with Rob definitely on this. I think the issue here is that the question of whether the climate is warming and humans are primarily responsible is a scientific question that I think all of us would agree has largely been answered. The question of what you do about that is a political question in which science plays a part, but is certainly not the whole answer. And I think one of the problems, and I think this may have been a green tactical error in some ways, is that, and indeed climate scientists are guilty of this sometimes too, is that the politics and the science have sometimes become confused to the point that it has become the case almost that if you buy the science, you buy a particular political solution to that problem. And I don't think that necessarily follows. What that invites then is for people who reject the political solution, i.e. Kyoto Agreement and all of that kind of thing, to reject the science. And I think that's one of the reasons why you see this rather bizarre left-right split on climate change. I mean, the question of whether carbon dioxide causes global warming or not is not ultimately a left-right question. That's not about whether you're conservative or liberal. There's no conservative physics and liberal physics in relation to that. But I think the problem is it's the solutions that conservatives don't like. It ought to be perfectly possible to buy the science of climate change completely and yet to reject all of the solutions that we've advanced so far, but it's becoming increasingly hard to take that position. Not that I do.
In terms of embedding scientific thinking further into policymaking, how far could the government really go? Could they, for example, use randomised controlled trials to try out different policies to find out which one works best? Here's David Willetts again.
Well, Ben Goldacre and others are eloquent on sort of randomised controlled trials. And you can, increasingly, the work that you see in foresight reports from the Office of the Chief Scientist, work indeed I see in done for individual government departments, the Home Affairs Committee discussion, which I remember on policy on mental health, drew very heavily on the mental capital and well-being foresight exercise earlier. And those, in turn, often do draw on things like randomised controlled trials. So they can be drawn on. They should be drawn on more. You can learn from what works and what doesn't work in other countries. I don't think they can be the complete be-all and end-all. And indeed, one of the tensions we face in government is the government. We believe in localism and letting a thousand flowers bloom and trying out different solutions. But sometimes the political pressures are to do the right thing across the country as a whole. And people are uncomfortable with the idea that policy should be different in Bristol and Birmingham and Bradford. We are in a unitary political culture, and we have to respect that. But the more that we can draw on randomised controlled trials, we should. And I think already they do have an influence through the background reports that you see in Biz Economics papers, that you see in the Cabinet Office work on social mobility and elsewhere, that you see in some of the Department of Health work and obesity and mental health.
We've talked about how politicians can get better scientific advice and empirical evidence and your ambitions to sort of spread that across government. What would your message to scientists be to sort of also help that process along?
I think one thing that they can do is apply the... Sometimes you can apply sophistication to policy proposals as well as to neutral analysis. In other words, I think one of the strengths of, say, the Institute of Physical Studies, which is a think tank supported by the research of the ESRC, Research Council, government-funded, and in the broadest sense, as I say, certainly empiricist, even if it's not physical science, what they're good at is they analyse policy options rigorously. And that itself is a skill, and sometimes a little bit different from just the observation of data. Confidence by scientists onto policymaking, vice versa, is very useful.
A question for all three of you. A lot of this depends on politicians being ready to take on board some of these things. Politicians famously, and quite rightly, only really respond to things that will get them elected. So if the members of the public in their constituency all want homeopathic medicines that you know, and they can't get elected without thinking that those things are amazing, then potential MP has a problem. Will MPs, politicians, ever get to the stage that you want them to get to until members of the public in the UK aren't scientifically literate too?
Well, I think that will only happen if people who really care a great deal about science actually stand up and make those views known. I mean, this is very much the theme of my book, The Geek Manifesto, that people who have this broad affinity for science, who understand that actually it's not about what you know so much as about how you know it and how you go about finding things out. But until people like that start to make a fuss, rather better than they have done historically, about the kind of problems we've been talking about today, politicians will know they can get away with them, and therefore they won't change. I mean, there are some encouraging signs that that's starting to change. I think if you looked at the furore that followed the sacking of Professor David Nutt as the government's chief drugs advisor, for example, there are a few other examples, extra-parliamentary, perhaps the Simon Singh libel case. It's starting to change, but there's a long way to go.
So, Rob, we need a science vote in the way that there is a gay vote or an elderly vote or that kind of thing.
I'd be cautious about that. What I was saying earlier is that there has been academic research on the role of science in public policy, and there's been a couple of lessons, I think, that have, you know, general lessons that we can draw from that. One we've discussed, which is the limits of scientific knowledge and the importance of recognising uncertainty. on the other side of the coin, I think it's also very important to recognize that when we're talking about science and public policy, nearly always we're really talking about public problems, policy problems with a science dimension. And I think that we have to be very careful about not defining them in terms of their science, because too often people who are very strongly identified as scientists misunderstand the nature of the public policy problem and assume that it is principally defined by its science. And then when other people take a different view, get very confused at best, or at worst start to call people that come to a different conclusion, you know, irrational or wrong. And so, you know, the classic examples of that would be GM food and MMR, crises, if you like, in public confidence in scientific regulation, which are very complicated to understand. And in order to understand properly, we need to see that they're kind of public questions, let's say in both cases, one around food and the other around health and parents' duties towards their children and patients' choice. Very, very complicated, with very strong science elements. But the trouble is we just have to be very careful about working out where science fits into the broader public problem. I would say that we just have to be very careful there, not assuming that science will have, you know, does determine the nature of the problem at hand.
Chris, if there's some way still to go with all of this in terms of exposing politicians to scientists and working out the role of science exactly, what about scientific methods? For example, you don't see many policies being trialed in a sort of randomized controlled way in the way that medicines are, for example. Could scientific methods like that be useful for government policy?
Of course they could. Of course, the difficulty with doing trials is that they cost money. So that's not a popular proposal right now. But I think a lot of this actually comes back to people. You know, we can talk about issues and issues, but it really comes back to people. And the more connections we have between the already outstanding research base we have in the UK and the people who are making decisions at the heart of government, the better off will be. At the Centre for Science and Policy, for example, we run a programme called Policy Fellowships, where we bring in policymakers for a period of intensive meetings with researchers. Each year we'll have 30 policymakers come through, meeting around 30 academics. So we're talking in the space of a year, 900 face-to-face interactions.
Do you see results out of that? Do you see politicians getting better at science or scientists getting more into politics?
Absolutely, both. Perhaps the biggest impact is putting the policy issues that policymakers are dealing with into a bigger context, both a bigger context in terms of the research base and also in terms of an understanding of what the possible options are. That only comes about by interactions between people. You can, you know, academic reports and policy reports and formal mechanisms are all important, but it's those serendipitous meetings between key people that you've got no other way of knowing where they're going to come from, but it's those serendipitous meetings that have a really big impact.
Let me wind up by asking each of you the same question. In the challenges you've outlined, who do you think are the people that most need to be convinced to do something today? Is it the politicians? Is it scientists? Is it members of the public? Is it, who is it that needs to do something or be encouraged to do something that would have the greatest soonest impact? Mark?
In the short term, it's the politicians and the civil servants. But actually, in the long term, it's all of us. And it's particularly those of us, I think, who care about the issues that we're discussing today. If it becomes seen as part of politics that you have to be comfortable with this sort of thing, or you will be punished electorally for it, then politicians are going to make it their business to get on top of this kind of thing.
Rob?
It may only be a small part of the puzzle, but I'm passionate about trying to improve the research we have on the role of science in policy. And in doing so, working with the policymakers who have to deal with the stuff and the academics who can do the research to build up a shared research agenda. That, as I said, that'll only be a small part of the overall picture, but that's one that I think we can make progress on.
So do you mean research looking at which policies work and why?
Yeah, and how evidence has played a part in that. Yeah.
I'm going to be bold and say the research community. The relationship between the scientific community and policy, it's a relatively new focus of attention. For a bit longer, people have been interested in the relationship between the scientific community and the media. And I remember when the Science Media Centre was started, Fiona Fox, who runs the Science Media Centre, said the media will learn to do science better when science learns to do media better. And I think she was bang right. She's been proven right about that. And I think the same is true of policy. Policy will learn to do science better once science learns to do policy better.
That's all we have time for. Thanks very much to Chris Tyler and Rob Doubleday from the University of Cambridge Centre for Science and Policy. Also, thanks to Mark Henderson, whose book The Geek Manifesto will be published in May. Thanks also to Imran Khan from the Campaign for Science and Engineering, and also to David Willits. The producer of this podcast was Ian Chambers. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.